Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
We're back. This is Interpreter Radio. If you are just joining us, you're suggested to go take a look at the podcast online and listen to it. Our first hour, we talked about the First Presidency's urging members of the church in a recent letter to be vaccinated and to wear masks when appropriate and to use appropriate social distancing. During this segment of our program, which, by the way, is the Interpreter Radio Show and is supported and produced by the Interpreter Foundation, which defends the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, provides for scholarly material and articles and research, and answers questions for Latter-day Saints and others. During this segment of our program, our co-hosts, Michael Parker and Chris Fredrickson, and I will be going through the Come Follow Me lesson for sections 106, 107, and 108 of the Doctrine and Covenants. We'll certainly spend the bulk of our time this hour on section 107, but to keep them in order, we start off with section 106. The background for this section is that Joseph Smith in early 1834 was going around and visiting the different branches of the church that had been established. And as he was doing so, he stopped in a little village called Freedom, New York, where he was put up and entertained by Warren Cowdery, who was Oliver Cowdery's brother. And they had a great time. And Joseph Smith wrote that as he stayed at Warren Cowdery's house, quote, "We were blessed with the full enjoyment of temporal and spiritual blessings, even all we needed or were worthy to receive," close quotes. Joseph Smith's influence, apparently at that meeting, at that visit, and elsewhere, had some great fruits because Warren was eventually baptized. That fall, several months later, Joseph Smith was busy and he started to think about the end of the year and the coming back of the elders who had been sent out. And he started to make preparations for the School of the Elders, which we now call the School of the Prophets. And he indicated that he received a revelation on November 25th, and that revelation is what we now have as section 106. And so that background is almost more than the actual contents of 106, which is fairly short, but it has an interesting background. So any comments about section 106 and its contents? There are some interesting things here.
Chris, go right ahead.
I mean, there's a couple of little gems here. I mean, what we also know is that, you know, he's going to preach in the area, and there's going to be about 30 to 40 converts, and so that's going to lead them to organize a branch. And then when they call a presiding high priest over the church in Freedom, New York, it's going to be Warren Cowdery. This is Oliver Cowdery's older brother. I think there's a family of 8 or 10 kids. But this is Oliver's older brother, and the Lord's just going to give him some personal counsel. But it's also, in many respects, counsel that we can apply to ourselves. But I also think it's thought-provoking in some ways. He's a relatively new convert to the church. He's not only told here that he's going to be the presiding high priest over this branch, so, you know, the branch president, or, you know, sort of we sometimes think of bishop in that respect. But it also says in verse 3, and devote your whole time to this high and holy calling. seeking diligently the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness. It wasn't unusual in the 19th century for people, probably perhaps a perfect example, to give up everything and just go off preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. They feel this call by the Spirit to go preach. But this, you know, this is a pretty onerous task that lies before Warren Calgary when it says devote his whole time. It talks about the laborer is worthy of his hire. And, you know, this is a 19th century world. It's an agrarian society. Well, we're moving into industrialization about mid-century, but there's still plenty, especially in upstate New York and stuff, agrarian, you know, society during this period of time with the Erie Canal and everything that's going on at this period of time. And so these people are laborers, and they understand what it is to labor and to work hard and then to realize the fruits of your efforts. And so he's being, you know, reminded here, you know, gird up your loins, get to work, and build the kingdom of God, and that's what you are asked to do. And you can imagine, you know, he certainly feels the pressure of this, and we know, unfortunately, that when Oliver leaves the church, that he will leave as well. Oliver, of course, will come back to the faith. He will stay east, and he never comes back to the faith. But there's some good counsel here. It talks about being children of light. You know, today in section 88, I mean, 88 is replete with references to light and the law, you know, turning towards the Savior and turning away from darkness. And so good counsel for all of us, I think. And, you know, to make sure that you understand that that second coming, you know, draws closer every day, and don't let yourself be overtaken, you know, as a thief sneaking into your house in the middle of the night, but have an eye single to the glory of God. So, you know, those are just some of the things that I take from 106.
Mike?
Oh, just one thought. I love verse 7, only because if I were Warren Calgary, I probably would have been taken aback a bit by that, that the Lord, through Joseph, says, "Blessed is my servant Warren, for I will have mercy on him. And notwithstanding the vanity of his heart, I will lift him up." Like, oh, ouch, okay, thanks. So there's little nuggets like that in Joseph's, and sometimes you see that directed to Joseph as well. So, you know, he was an equal opportunity offender, the Lord was, you know, and all these things. So.
Well, yeah, and apparently Warren Cowdery was humble enough that he could take things like this because he was a stalwart guy for after his joining the church anyway. That's a great point. I like that. That's a great point.
And there's that little promise, too, where he says, I will give you, Warren, grace and assurance wherewith you may stand. In other words, the Lord's going to buoy him up. You know, he'll go before him. He'll be behind him. He will encompass him in his love. He will allow him to accomplish the things that he needs to accomplish. Just get to work and do it, even though you're human and you have some flaws and foibles.
Great comment. I just had one short thought, and that deals with verses 4 and 5. We often talk about the second coming as being very, very different from Jesus' earthly ministry because there was no fanfare when Jesus came. Few people knew about it. And in contrast, we're told that at the second coming, all the world will see it together. It's going to be this marvelous and enormous event. It's called the Great and Dreadful Day of the Lord. Great for people who are ready, dreadful for those who don't believe in it, and so forth. And yet, to a certain extent, we have a different idea about the second coming. It's expressed in many places that it will come like a thief in the night. And that kind of imagery is expressed here, where, as we also read in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and in 1 Peter chapter 3, there are these ideas that the second coming is going to creep up on people and they just won't be aware of it. And I remember teaching a youth Sunday school class many years ago where somebody said, "Well, wait a minute, those things can't both be true. I mean, if everybody sees it all together, then it's not going to creep up like a thief at night. Everybody's going to see it. It's going to be all out in the open. And as I've thought about that interesting comment then and since, the point is that the way it's going to be as a thief in the night is in the sense that we're not, at least some people, hopefully not us, many people will not be prepared for it. It's not that they won't see it when it happens. It will come as a thief in the night because they won't be ready for it. Once the thief breaks in, you know he's there, and it's no surprise. But his coming is something that is not seen or understood. And so I don't know that anyone in our audience here would have a problem distinguishing those two concepts, but I think they're important to think about, that there really is no contradiction between the idea that the second coming will be as a thief in the night, but that it will also be a worldwide event which all people will see together. Other thoughts on 106?
Well, I think that idea too of you know, that it will come as a thief in the night. I think that is the Lord trying to warn us against being in that category of people. Because there are plenty of people that see and are aware of the signs of the times, and they see these events drawing closer. We have no idea when, you know, they will come to fruition. But there are many people that simply don't want to see them, that ignore them, that turn their back on them. And that's why it's kind of contrasted here, I think, against being children of the light. Sort of reminds you, is it 86 where it says, stand ye in holy places? You know, we talk about this phrase, be children of the light. What does that mean? That means that we surround ourselves with light and with enervating and with uplifting things. And as we do that, we'll more clearly see and we'll more clearly understand the signs of the times and what is happening. And we will want to, and we will strive to endear ourselves to the Savior Jesus Christ by living the principles of the gospel. You know, we will want to, you know, embrace light. Although we see that there certainly are individuals in the world that want to embrace darkness and that intentionally do so. So we're seeing this divide, and you know, there's a lot we can learn from just these few words here.
Thank you. Great comments. Mike, you had an introduction to section 107.
Yeah, 107 is really interesting as far as where it came from. Set the stage here, we've got to go back all the way to the fall of 1831. There's a two-week period from the 29th of October, 1831, and the 12th of November, 1831. So 14 days right there, well, 15 actually. The prophet recorded 9 revelations in those days. I mean, this was a really, you know, he was really on. There was a major conference of the church where leaders met. This is kind of the beginning of the first presidency comes out of this.
Did we lose your mic?
I'm not hearing him.
I'm not hearing him either. Mike, call us back. Somehow we've lost you. Perhaps your phone lost a battery or something. Give us a call right back, please. So just some more about the historical background of Section 107. One of the things that happened was ultimately on March 12th of 1835, there was a meeting of the 12. Orson Hyde, William McClellan were acting as clerks, and they recorded, quote, "This evening the 12 assembled, and the council was opened by President Joseph Smith Jr., and he proposed that we take our first mission through the eastern states to the Atlantic Ocean and hold conferences in the vicinity of the several branches of the church for the purpose of regulating all things necessary for their welfare." It was proposed that the 12 leave Kirtland on May 4th, and that was March 12th, so that's less than 2 months later. And on March 28th of 1835, Elder Hides and McClellans also wrote more about further meetings and the directions that the church was supposed to go to move forward. And so it's quite fascinating. Ultimately, Joseph Smith inquires the Lord about worthiness, about the direction of the first presidency, about the direction of the Quorum of the Twelve. And in response to those inquiries, we had Section 107 that was received. Any other thoughts, Chris, that you might have on Section 107?
Yeah, the only thing I'd add is that, you know, the Lord's commanded Joseph Smith to gather together all the men that participated in Zion's camp. And we can't begin to understand the kind of sacrifices that the individuals made that in many respects they thought came to nothing because they didn't go to battle to save their brethren. And yet the Lord explained, you know, this was made very clear afterwards that that wasn't the purpose. This was a testing to see who was qualified to be leaders in the church, pretty much. I'm paraphrasing here. And so, and you'll remember as well that the three witnesses, they had been authorized a bit of time earlier to select the 12 from among the members of Zion's camp. They'd been authorized to select the 12. And so they're getting together here in Kirtland in February 1835. And they're not only going to select, leaders of the church, but they're also going to select the 12. I think what's really interesting here is, let's be real, they have no idea what they're getting into. They have absolutely no idea what it means to be called to be a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. They might think, well, pretty prestigious. And I think in some sense it is, and it should be seen that way, because these are individuals that certainly have qualified themselves, especially, I shouldn't say especially today, but today we certainly see it this way. But, you know, for some of them, it was a call for martyrdom. They're going to have to give their lives. They weren't aware of the trials. They weren't aware of responsibility here. They weren't aware of the authority that they're to bear. I'll quote George Q. Cannon. He said, of the disciples chosen then, and of those sent to keep the Quorum complete, not one has escaped the afflictions of time. And President Lee, also said, with some the pains were too intense to be endured, the burden too heavy to be borne, and they dropped aside from the on-marching ranks to find, as they hoped, repose and safety amidst the cooling shadows of the world from which they had been chosen to be special witnesses of the Son of God. Such were no longer his apostles. But the others, with unshaken resoluteness, have gone forward in the fulfillment of their high mission under the scorching heat of fiery persecution. Joseph is their captain and their fellow soldier in the cause of Christ. With him and after him, many of them have, with continuous and unyielding zeal, toiled steadily on until worn out in the performance of the duty assigned them by their master, Jesus. One of the other things I find most intriguing about 107 is, we have the oath and covenant of the priesthood, and we have the restoration of the priesthood and priesthood power and keys and authority and, these kinds of things. And yet with 107, it sort of reminds me, I always use this analogy in class, it reminds me of that the priesthood has been restored to the earth by this period of time, but we're right in that state where the priesthood is sort of akin to Hoover Dam. There's enormous power in the waters there, and yet they have to be harnessed and directed for good use, and also that they can be widely distributed throughout the earth. It's really quite fascinating. We live in a church where we certainly do, and we'll see this as we talk about Section 107. We have leaders at the head of the church, and in many respects, the church is top-down. Priesthood, keys, power, and authority, presiding high priest or the president of the church. He holds all those priesthood keys, and he distributes them accordingly. But then we distribute them vastly and widely throughout the earth I don't think there's a theological organization in the world that does what we do, that literally puts priesthood power and authority in the hands of 12-year-old boys that would be just as happy to be spending their days sometimes at the donut shop. And yet the Lord has extraordinary trust in these individuals. And so what we see here is we see the organization of the church. How do we pull all of this together? How do we harness this power? How do we organize a church? And if you look at this blueprint, you know, this is at a time when the church is relatively minuscule in numbers. And yet today it's this vast organization, and there have been some, you know, practical changes to the organization of, you know, these priesthood quorums and how they function and what they do. But this organizational structure still really holds when we've gone from a church of, you know, a couple of thousand, several hundred, to millions of individuals, and it is still a sublime model for individuals today.
Which is quite an amazing thing. Mike, do we have you back?
I'm back. I do not know what happened. My phone just suddenly hung up, and I tried calling you, and it said the number was not available. I don't know.
I am sure it was somebody who didn't like our comments about the first presidency letter that just kind of... Anyway, all right, we'll leave that alone. It's good to have you back. Anything else you'd like to add by way of background information here before we jump right into 107?
Don't know what I missed. So I did start to say that there were 9 revelations recorded by the prophet in this is 2-week period in 1831. 66, 65, 68, section 1 is in there. And one of these was partial, set part of 107. Now, this comes fairly early, and this is right after the concept of a high, the office of high priest had been revealed. It had been revealed in the summer of 1831. So the prophet kind of sat on that. He didn't publish it early on, and then later in March or April of 1835, he received another revelation, and then he merged the two of them together, and that became what we now call section 107. And what's most interesting to me about this is, and I think I caught the tail end of what Chris was saying, and she might have covered this, but that early on, the offices of the priesthood in the church were very, very simple. They were elder, priest, teacher, and deacon. And that was what was in section 20. And that was it. There were 4 priesthood offices, and there was no division of Melchizedek or Aaronic. All of that came later as the church grew and developed. And it's not until 1835 that we actually see a teaching of there's a Melchizedek priesthood and there's an Aaronic priesthood. We have these two priesthoods that are really one priesthood, and dividing of the offices between the two. So there's just something I think it's helpful to understand is the church didn't spring full flower on April 6, 1830, with a first presidency and a quorum of 12 and, you know, high priests and elders and... you know, et cetera, et cetera, that this was a ongoing thing that was slowly revealed over several years and even is still being revealed today with high priest groups being done away with a few years ago and high priests and elders now meet as single elders quorum. You know, the revelation, the restoration is ongoing, as they say. So.
Well, I teach my students with the organizational structure of the church in 1830 was a first and second elder.
Yeah, that was entire leadership, yeah.
Years ago when I was in undergrad school, I took a management class, and the professor, who was not LDS, made a very interesting comment. He said that if you look at management theory, the LDS Church had done some remarkable things. The first one was that although it followed many good rules of management, it seemed to violate some of the major tenets that were generally acceptable about how to run an organization effectively, and yet it was still incredibly successful. And then he went on to state that the other thing it had done that looked almost miraculous, and he didn't use the word miraculous, but I don't remember what he said, you know, surprising or something along those lines. But the gist of his comment was that the church had managed to grow from small to medium size to large and then to very large, which then was nothing like it is now, and yet still remain effective with the basic management structure that it had put in place intact. And he was incredulous at that. He thought there's no other organization that he could think of that had been really effective in that regard. So I've long thought about that from essentially an outsider who made those observations. All right, should we dive into the subject matter? Who wants to start us off with the actual verses of Section 107?
I guess I'd be happy to.
Go for it.
I kind of start with the first six verses, which are the real first indication that we have of a... In the church, there are two priesthoods, or, in other words, two divisions or grand heads of the priesthood. Joseph Smith thought that all priesthood is Melchizedek. So you can call it two priesthoods if you want, but the Aaronic is a division within the Melchizedek priesthood and is subordinate to it. The first priesthood is, the full name of it is disclosed in verses 2 and 3. It's the holy priesthood after the order of the Son of God, which, for convenience, because it's shorter and also to avoid the repeating the name of deity too often, which is an interesting concept of speaking that too much. Can we speak God's name too much? I don't know. Apparently we can. Just simply shortened to the Melchizedek priesthood, because Melchizedek was such a great high priest. And, of course, we learn from Genesis chapter 14, and especially the Joseph Smith translation of that chapter, that Melchizedek was a priest of the Most High God, and that Abraham paid tithes to him after the Battle of the Kings. We don't learn a lot about Melchizedek from the Bible. Most of it we know from Joseph's revelations. And 107 and 84 goes on to, they both are dovetail very well into each other, talking about the specific rites and keys of the Melchizedek priesthood. 107 verse 8 says it holds the rite of presidency. 107 verse 18 says it holds the keys of all the spiritual blessings of the church. And then 84:19 and 107:19 both say that the Melchizedek priesthood holds the key of the mysteries of the kingdom, mystery referring to something that is revealed by God only to an initiated few, and the temple ordinances would be included in that. And there are other keys. Verse 19 of 107 talks about to have the heavens open to commune with the General Assembly and Church of the Firstborn and enjoy communion in the presence of the Father, and Jesus the mediator of the new covenant. So there are more in there, but the idea here being that the Melchizedek priesthood is that priesthood which unlocks all of the blessings that are available to both men and women to return to the presence of God. And the ultimate expression of that is, of course, found in the temple. And priesthood is not spoken of there as a male thing. It is both male and female. Men and women both participate and receive the same blessings and make the same covenants. And I just want to mention as an aside, if you haven't been to the temple since it's reopened after the pandemic, that concept is taught more clearly than it ever has been. There's a lot of things in the temple that have, you know, finally kind of come around to everyone's, we're all doing the same thing here. There's no real, I don't want to say division, but there's no separation between men and women as far as the covenants that are entered into and the blessings that are promised. So go back to the temple. I would recommend that to everybody.
Great comments. Chris.
The prophet Joseph Smith, and teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, he kind of gives us an expansive understanding of the priesthood. He says, the priesthood was first given to Adam. He obtained the first presidency and held the keys of it from generation to generation. He obtained it in the creation before the world was formed. As explained in Genesis 1, 26 through 28, he had dominion given him over every living creature. He is Michael the archangel, spoken of in the scripture. The priesthood is an everlasting principle and existed with God from eternity and will to eternity. The keys have to be brought from heaven whenever the gospel is sent. When they are revealed from heaven, it is by Adam's authority. This then is the nature of the priesthood. Every man holding the presidency of his dispensation, and one man holding the presidency of them all, even Adam, and Adam receiving his presidency and authority from the Lord. And, you know, in describing sort of the Melchizedek and Aaronic priesthood, I love Joseph Smith in the History of the Church. He says, although there are two priesthoods, yet the Melchizedek priesthood comprehends the Aaronic or Levitical priesthood and is the grand head and holds the highest authority which pertains to the priesthood. So it's almost like within this very wide bubble, there is that smaller bubble, that Aaronic priesthood that is comprehended by the Melchizedek priesthood. And, you know, I kind of, this is strictly me, but I kind of see it as sort of like, you know, the majors and the minors. And that Aaronic priesthood is that preparatory. It's preparing you for the major leagues. It's preparing you for the privileges, the responsibilities, but the really quite onerous and strict duties that are associated with exercising priesthood power and authority. So, I mean, you know, this is something that men, women certainly need to understand. And I sometimes, you know, I see these cute little 12-year-old boys just passing the priesthood, and we'll talk a little bit more about them and, you know, what the promises are to the Aaronic priesthood. They're absolutely exquisite. But you just want them to say, do you realize, I never had any idea, I'm sure my brothers didn't, I don't know that my kids did, what it really means. I mean, imagine, you know, your father saying, oh, here are the keys to the Bugatti, one of the most expensive cars made. Go, you know, be careful, but you can use my car. That's mind-boggling to us. And yet, look what the Lord is doing, beginning at a very young age. He has such trust and confidence in his children that he allows them access to, you know, priesthood authority and priesthood power. And the training in the priesthood is really quite exquisite because I would suggest that it crosses into, you know, that temporal world that we live in, and certainly does prepare young men in myriad ways to take up jobs and professions, not only to lead the church, but to lead in the world as well.
Well, Chris, I must say that for you, the woman in the co-hosting group tonight, to use baseball and a Bugatti as teaching tools is surprising and great. So I appreciated both of those, especially frankly, the baseball one. I think that's a great analogy for Melchizedek and Aaronic priesthood. The one subsumes the other, but they're part of the same priesthood, and yet there is an Aaronic and there is a Melchizedek priesthood. Great analogy. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Let's move on.
You know what?
Go ahead.
I know I'm respectful of the name, but gosh, I think once in a while the young men and young women should be reminded that this priesthood is the holy priesthood after the order of the Son of God. It's stunning if you really take the time to just kind of ponder, you know, what this, it's not, you know, it's named after Melchizedek priesthood, as Mike mentioned, the reasons for it. But when we consider, you know, what this priesthood really is, and that we have the privilege and blessing to participate in, you know, priesthood power and authority and for men keys, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. Thank you. We are about 20 minutes or so from the end of the program, so let's move on and hit some of the highlights. We'll never be able to get to all the details of Section 107. One of the fascinating points for me is verse 22, which talks about the fact that, well, when you get right down to it, the gist of 107:22 is that the entire first presidency and the 12 all have the same authority. And of course, there's a president of the church. There's the first presidency. But all of the members of the first presidency and all members of the Council of the Twelve are sustained as prophets, seers, and revelators. And this means that if a president of the church passes away, or anyone else in the first presidency or Council of the Twelve does so, if someone else is chosen by that group, they have the same power and authority. And that's such a fascinating governing principle. I think it's elegant, it's simple, and it works so well, and it seems so divinely inspired to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you'll remember that Brigham Young, you know, just prior to Joseph's death, that he speaks, and others speak very, very, very eloquently about the prophet Joseph Smith. He knows his time is coming to a close. He's very well aware of that. And he's doing everything he can to prepare the brethren and the quorum of the 12. And he says, you know, I roll the, I don't know exactly the exact phraseology, but it's something that I roll the keys, you know, off upon your shoulders. You have everything you need to go forward. This is what gives Brigham Young the confidence to stand before the members of the church after Joseph has been martyred, and to say to them that we're okay, the quorum of the 12 will lead the church. And they don't immediately choose a prophet, as you well know. It's going to be, you know, till they're in winter quarters there. But they're not going to pick a prophet right away, but the 12 is going to lead the church for some period of time. And all of this because there's order and there's law in God's kingdom. And you see this over and over again in section 107 as they, you know, explicate the order of the priesthood of God on the earth and how it needs to function and how it can effectively function. And I think you mentioned verse 22, but I think one of the most important verses is verse 22, where it says, "Is how are these men able to do what they do and to carry out this responsibility?" And the women that lead the Relief Society and the young ones, how do these women do it? And you know what? They're able to do it as they are upheld by the confidence, faith, and prayer of the members of the church. We have to have confidence in these individuals, and we can. You know, I have confidence in President Nelson. I had some questions about this COVID thing. I have confidence that he is a prophet of God. And I took that to my Father in heaven in prayer. I have confidence in him. I have faith in him. And as I prayed and sought those answers, they're going to come. But we have to uphold our leaders. There's nothing worse than divisiveness. You know, there's nothing worse than a lack of unity. And so, you know, this is, we have a, just as they have heavy responsibilities and duties, so do we. And it's to uphold them in these callings and in these heavy, heavy burdens that they carry.
Yeah, absolutely so. And dovetailing in with that, in verses 27 through 32, you've got this concept of unity. And we are told many times in different contexts by the members of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve that they are united in their decision-making. That doesn't mean they always agree. If they don't agree, they table something and take it up later. And they don't actually make any significant decisions without some kind of, without actual unanimity. And that, to me, is quite exciting and also amazing. Try to get 12 people on any board of directors anywhere in a non-Latter-day Saint religious context to agree on anything. It would be pretty difficult, I would venture to guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Every decision made by either of these quorums must be by the unanimous voice of the same. A majority may form a quorum when circumstances render it impossible, you know, to do otherwise. But there's to be unanimity. And look at, you know, we sometimes think about what it would be like to be a general authority that's traveled halfway around the world to a stake president, you know, to a stake to reorganize the stake and to call people to callings, and you're up, you fly all night, and then you drive halfway across the country, and you get there, and you're working, and then you go to some wonderful family's home, and they're going to house you for the night, and they're going to put on a lovely meal, and their daughter wants to play the piano for you, and all you want to do is just go to bed and get some sleep. You know, I mean, that's the least of the things that they have to deal with, because, you know, beyond that, here it says that they are to, their decisions are to be made in all righteousness, in holiness, lowliness of heart, meekness, long-suffering, faith, virtue, knowledge, temperance, patience, godliness, brotherly kindness, and charity. And that's what these men, they legitimately, this is what they legitimately strive after. I'm constantly struck by their temperament, and they're humble individuals. I mean, they truly are. The humility among these individuals is really quite striking, and they strive to be disciples of Jesus Christ with all the demands that are placed upon them. But there's that standard that's before them, and then, of course, they must be witnesses of the divinity of the Son of God and of, you know, his mission on the earth.
Great comments. Mike, your turn.
Martin, you mentioned the verse 24 talks about the 12 apostles form a quorum equal in authority and power to the three presidents, the first presidency. But, of course, quorum of the 12 operates under the direction of the first presidency. What's interesting to me is that there's actually an entire custody chain here that kind of works its way down. If you look at verse 26, it says that the quorums of the 70 collectively are equal in authority to that of the 12 special witnesses or apostles. However, verse 34 tells us that they act under direction of the 12. And so they would only be empowered to use the keys of the kingdom if both the first presidency and the quorum of the 12 ceased to exist. If for some reason there was something catastrophic where all 15 members of the first presidency and the quorum of the 12 all died, the quorums of the 70 collectively hold the keys and could reconstitute the first presidency and quorum of the 12, which is why this is the 70 is a general authority level calling. Some people may be old enough to remember, as I am barely old enough to remember this, but I do remember when there were 70s quorums at the stake level in 1986. That was all done away with, and they reverted their role as general authorities in accordance with the scriptures. What's even more interesting to me, though, is if you go to verse 36, we learn that all the standing high councils of the church, organized in its stakes, they form a quorum equal in authority to the first presidency and quorum of the 12. Now, you have to keep in mind that when this revelation was written in 1835, there were only two standing high councils. There's one in Kirtland, and there's another in Missouri. Even so, in the very unlikely circumstance that the First Presidency, the Quorum of the Twelve, and all the quorums of the 70 suddenly ceased to exist, the church leadership could be reconstituted through a special conference of all stake high councils. I don't know how that would be accomplished, but in theory, you could do it. So the church is well taken care of. I mean, the brethren are very careful not to have all of them all in the same place at the same time. If you've ever noticed in general conference, they don't have the entire quorum of the 12 on the stand. They'll have one or two off, you know, presiding at tabernacle or the assembly hall or so forth. And, you know, the part of that is for safety, that if something tragic were to happen, you've got to have somebody left who holds the keys. But, in theory, if something, the worst disaster were to take place, the church is well taken care of. We're okay there.
Yes, indeed. Years ago, actually, in the 1980s, I for a time worked and had an assignment out at the nuclear power plant, which is required to have 7 different redundancies for any of the major functions of the plant. So if one went out, there was a second backup. If that went out, there was a third, and so on. And there was a guy who was over all these redundant features of the plant, and for his birthday one day, somebody got him a plaque for his desk that said, Chief Head of the Department of Redundancy Department Head. And I thought, that's pretty good. And in a way, That's what the church has done here. There are so many backup systems here that there is virtually zero chance that somehow leadership will not be appropriately handled. And I appreciate you very much, Mike, bringing that point up. That's something that's not often mentioned about the 70s and about the High Council. That's great points.
I'd like to mention, if I can, and I don't want to steer away from 70s, if can we talk about the patriarch?
Sure, just a moment. Please. That's great.
Verse 39. Yeah, this is an interesting one to me because, of course, we do not have a church patriarch anymore. And some people who are slightly older than I am may remember when we used to have one. And there's not a lot in the scriptures about it, which I think is part of the reason why we may not have one anymore. But verse 39 does mention that one of the duties of the 12 is to ordain evangelical ministers within the church. Now, this is a reference to patriarchs. Joseph Smith thought that an evangelist is a patriarch.
Yes.
And so we have this today where every stake has at least one patriarch who gives patriarchal blessings. There used to be, however, along with the first presidency of the Quorum of the Twelve, there was a patriarch to the church who held the sealing keys. This is mentioned in section 124, verse 124. And this office was originally held by Joseph Smith Sr. and then by Hiram Smith, and it was passed down from father to son, unlike other priesthood offices in the church. And this is what verse 40 is talking about when it says the order of this priesthood, it's referring to the patriarchal priesthood, was confirmed to be handed down from father to son, literal descendants, and it begins this, you know, to get this genealogy thing here. And that's how that was handled. So you have Joseph Smith Sr. to his oldest living son, Hiram Smith, and then due to unusual circumstances, two men who were not related to the Smith family held that office for brief periods in church history. There was a bit of a tension there because when you have this handed down to from father to son, what happens if you have a son who's not entirely stable, I guess is the right word? And there were a couple of presiding patriarchs who had, you know, short terms and were released because there were issues. They didn't even know what to call this. The title of the office was either patriarch to the church or presiding patriarch, and it kind of depended on how the president of the church at the time felt about it. But this patriarch met with the first presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve in their weekly meetings, held the sealing keys, member of the council. And that office was discontinued in October 1979. Eldridge G. Smith, who is now the late Eldridge G. Smith, he passed away just, a couple of years ago. He was the last serving patriarch. He was the great-great-grandson of Hiram Smith. He was honorably relieved of all duties and designated as patriarch emeritus. And now the church operates, according to 107, it's back at verse 39 that the 12 oversee evangelical ministers. So the office of patriarch is a little bit interesting in the priesthood because if you're an ordained patriarch, you really don't have a quorum. you meet with the elders, and of course you are, as a Melchizedek priesthood elder, you are an elder. But it's a bit of an odd, interesting office in the church. I have great respect for patriarchs in the church. I don't think I could ever do that.
Well, I'm sure you could, but it's a fascinating office, and great overview.
People come to their patriarch and they expect something big. Every person who comes, you know, this is going to be a life-changing moment, and you have to be spiritually on all the time.
Yeah, there's truth to that.
It's the spiritual load on those men is just unfathomable to me. So.
Yeah. Yes.
I appreciate the compliment, but yeah, no, thank you.
In our waning minutes here, I wanted to mention briefly verses 53 through 57 that talk about the Grand Council at Ottoman Diamond. We often talk about the Second Coming, but less often do we discuss that sometime prior to the Second Coming, there's going to be a meeting again, which will mirror a prior ancient meeting that happened with Adam and his posterity. And we don't have time to go into it in detail, but read these verses carefully, those who are listening. And I might also mention how seriously the church takes these verses. The church has been quietly and carefully buying up land in that area and developing it and improving it and making it a worthy and wonderful place for this grand council and for the second coming. The church takes this very seriously, these statements and prophetic pronouncements in verses 53 through 57.
Lovely. There's a couple of little things that I think are gems here, if that's okay.
Please,
in
yes.
In verse 20, when it talks about the Aaronic priesthood, and it says, they hold the keys of the ministering of angels. Now, there's a lovely definition. The keys of the ministering of angels means that a person is subject to the service of God's messengers. And so there are God's messengers that are available to serve them as they need them. And so, you know, if we apply this, young men of the Aaronic priesthood, they need to understand that the Lord is bound by solemn covenant to bless your lives according to your faithfulness. And, you know, if you heed the voice of the Holy Ghost and follow the direction, you will be blessed with the ministering of angels. And there's the promise that goes with that. That will add wisdom, knowledge, power, and glory to your life. And that's why this preparatory gospel. The thing that's quite interesting is, you know, if we look back at ancient Israel, this is sort of mentioned here too. Ancient Israel, we had the Mosaic Law, and it was the Levites that officiated in all these performance and ordinances. But in the church today, it's the Israelites. It's those that are of the house of Israel. Whether it's by natural right, or whether it's by birthright, or whether it's by being baptized into the church. And so we see again our Heavenly Father's extraordinary intention to spread this power and diffuse this power as widely as possible throughout the earth. And I think one of the other lovely things that it talks about here, and Elder Ballard has been speaking about this for so long, the importance of councils in this church. But all of these councils are there to aid and assist and to support one another. And that's what they do. And then I think the last little thing that I really love is, you know, who are these men that we call prophets? And, you know, I would suggest somebody open up a dictionary. Take time, open up a dictionary, but, you know, find the definition and find theological definition of these words, but what it means to be, as you mentioned earlier, Martin, a seer, a revelator, a translator, and a prophet, having all the gifts of God, which he bestows upon the head of the church. And, of course, in members of those quorums. And then, if I can read just 99 and 100, here's to me. Let every man and woman in the church learn their duty and to act in the office in which they are appointed in all diligence. He that is slothful shall not be counted worthy to stand, and he that learns not his duty and shows himself not approved shall not be counted worthy to stand. So we all have duties, responsibilities related to this extraordinary you know, blessing and privilege of having priesthood power in our life. And it comes with sustaining others and fulfilling our callings and taking advantage of that priesthood power that is accessible to faithful, worthy members of the church.
Thank you. Any final comments, Mike?
I think I've said everything I that I could. I do like, maybe just to close, the end of section 107. Wherefore, you know, after going through all of these offices and duties and so forth, it concludes with, wherefore, now let every man learn his duty to act in the office in which he is appointed in all diligence. He that is slothful shall not be counted worthy to stand, and he that learns not his duty and shows himself not approved shall not be counted worthy to stand. So there's this great clarion call at the end to, come on, get it together, magnify your callings, you know, be faithful priesthood holders. I think that's really a timeless message, and it's certainly appropriate for today and all the spiritual struggles that we face.
It is. Well said. Thank you. Take a look also at section 108, which, as a synopsis, talks about obedience to the commandments and to the pronouncements of the leaders of the church bring blessings, which I highly recommend people to take a look at. Thank you, Mike Parker. Thank you, Chris Fredrickson. And thank you to all those who are listening. I'm Martin Tanner, co-hosting. Join us again next week on Interpreter Radio.